want to be celebrating a birthday. What is there?
Congratulations.
Number six, yep. Thank you.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Okay, now it's time for the speaker portion of our meeting. It's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Donjay, all the way from Pleasant Hill.
Yeah, all the way. Hey, you did a great job. Kept it fresh. You got it. Happy birthday. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Don.
That's good. Ooh. My name's Don. I'm an alcoholic. And let me put this thing where I can follow the time, okay. Happy birthday and congratulations to all you guys. That's just amazing. I got to sit up front. Is that better? We have a limp mic. Is that better? Okay. My name's Don. I'm an alcoholic. And congratulations to everybody that was up here. I got to sit in that front row and watch the smile on your faces. And, you know, we get to see the light come on in the new people. And that's one of the greatest things that gifts I get when I come here, you know, to watch the fellowship grow up around us. The book tells us that that'll happen if we stick around long enough. So I'm going to get the most important thing I can tell you. The most important thing I can tell you, thank you, Coach, is that I've found a way of living that keeps me one step ahead of that demon alcohol as a result of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and great sponsorship. So that's probably the most important thing I can tell you tonight. But I'll get into my story right away. I was born 1950. I'm 75 years old. I made it that long. They were betting I wouldn't make it past 40. So I grew up in Pleasant Hill. My earliest memories are when I was 4 years old, 5 years old. My father doing horrible things to my mother like no man should do to any woman, no man should do to anybody. The police showing up, him scooting out of there just before they got there, and that was in 1955, and at that time, I swore I would never be like my father, I swore I would never drink. I've heard that promise from many people in these rooms, but what it did for me was it set in motion that feeling of being different like many of us have. It wasn't the worst, most horrible experience, childhood that a lot of people have, but it set in motion that 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity that our book talks about it. My earliest thoughts were, I had to prove to you that I was better than what I thought you thought I was. And that was pretty complicated. So what I did was threw myself into athletics and academics. And it turned out I was able to, and I'll just throw in another one. My mom got married again in 1962. She met a man. 30 days later, they came back from Reno. They were married. 30 days later, he was gone. Thank God for that strong woman. He was an alcoholic. My mom stood up to this disease and said, either get sober or get gone. This is 1962. And he left for 30 days, came back, and that man remained sober till the day he died in 1995. So I did have that influence in my life also. So I did really good in school. I had academic opportunities and athletic opportunities, mostly in the state of California. And I held true to that promise. I maybe drank once or twice in high school, quarter beer with the boys playing poker. I was afraid of the consequences if I drank. That didn't last for too long. So I got offers to go to play football in Southern California. My dream was to play college football. And my best buddy got an opportunity and an offer to scholarship to play basketball in the University of Oregon. And this was in 1968. So we went up to check out the campus in before the summer ended, and I fell in love with Eugene, Oregon, 500 miles away from home. And that guy that was afraid to explore, shall we say, was ready to explore. I was a square, a goody two shoes, whatever you want to call it. And so I transferred all my stuff and I was accepted to the University of Oregon. I got a hold of the coach and he sent me a playbook for the football team. And I registered in pre-med and very ambitious. And so when I got there, the coach assigned me a day to come and pick up my uniform. And they had the unofficial orientation, which was meet in the stairwell Friday night, be ready to have some fun. Now, I was ready to have some fun. I was ready to cut loose. So I walked down the hallway, and I heard the music playing. They were playing guitars, and they were singing Louie Louie. Some of you may remember that. And I opened the door to that stairwell. Somebody handed me an ice-cold Colt 45, tall. I drank that thing. I don't know, it was three sips, four sips, five sips, and I reached for another one. By the end of the night, I found the buyer for our dorm, Jean-Pierre, and ordered a case for the next night. Now, I don't know if that's alcoholic behavior, but it's a pretty good start for a guy that maybe drank once or twice and was afraid of the consequences. Here's the thing. On Monday, I went to the coach, and I said, you know, I think I changed my mind. I think I'm going to dedicate myself to my studies. I gave up one of my biggest dreams that quickly when alcohol came into this body. And I went to the academic advisor. And I said, well, pre-med's a little ambitious. I think I'll register in political science. And that's what I did. So I started off drinking every weekend. And back in 1968, there were some things going on in college campuses. There was a little skirmish going on in Southeast Asia. There was the Timothy Leary movement, turn on, tune in, drop out, wow. And then there was the rock and roll version on the West Coast, the Timothy Leary, Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, and it was drug, sex, and rock and roll. I chose that one. And as we went along, first year there was those little crosstop pills that helped you study really good, so I got involved in those. This is for a guy that never took a drug, and they had that leafy green substance all over the college campuses. I started taking that. By Christmas, my first term, I came home. I had hair down to here, smoking cigarettes, and my folks were horrified, you know. This is my mother who saved her whole life to put her son through college, you know, and I'm starting to change, and not for the good. I managed to do pretty good grade-wise for the first year, but it was just, I was lucky. My new badge of honor became, instead of the good athlete and the good student, I became the guy that had the stuff, the guy that could do the stuff. And it so in May of 1970, there was a little skirmish in Kent State where four college students got killed by the National Guard. And at that point, the last book I had read was Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Thomas Wolfe about Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. And that's the lifestyle I wanted to live. So I dropped out after Kent State. I dropped out of college 5 days after Kent State. I like to say I became a Rhodes Scholar. I hit the road. And for the next 4 years, I can't give you the chronological order of my life. I know I was in jail six times, and I know I got married in Las Vegas. So those were the main details from that time. So we hitchhiked back and forth across the country. We up and down the West Coast. It was a continuous thing. And I was having this great adventure. I thought I was going to be discovered. I thought I was going to be the next rock and roll star in the United States. I didn't know anybody in a band. I couldn't sing, and I didn't play an instrument. But that self-delusion by this time had really, really kicked in, you know. And the thing about that, and many of you have experienced similar experiences, that mother of mine, who saved her whole life to put her son through college, cried herself to sleep every night for 2 years, not knowing whether her son was dead in a ditch. We don't harm anybody but ourselves, do we? Well, that was what was happening. That was the reality of my life, and I had no clue. So after 4 years, I came off the road, and one of my buddies from college opened up a bar, a tavern in Portland, Oregon. It was on East Burnside, which was Skid Row, and it was called the Pilot House, and we changed it into this hot little rock and roll spot where we had bands from all over the Northwest, and we had all these, it is a rock and roll haven. And so they went home at daytime, at nighttime, and I came on shift in the afternoon. Well, there's a lot of beer there, and I like beer. And so I helped myself to all the beer, and not only that, but I invited my friends to join me. And when you're drinking beer 6, 8, 10 hours a day, sometimes you need a little help. At least I did. And there's this little white powdery stuff that really helps to carry you through that. And I didn't have any money, but I knew where the petty cash was. I knew how to get in the pinball machine. I knew how to get in the jukebox, and I helped myself. They confronted me on that. I could not believe it. After all, I had built that business, you know. If it wasn't for me, they wouldn't have had that success, that self-delusion. I had to rationalize and justify. I wouldn't have been able to stand a fiber in my being, you know. And that's, I don't know about you, but that's what I did a lot. I had to justify my behavior because I started becoming this really rotten person. And so they fired me. I could not believe it. In August of 1978, my stepdad opened a business called Builder Showplace, and it was in Concord. And back then, a little project named Blackhawk was being built up pretty good. And I came down, I went to work for them in August of 1978. As it turns out, I was a pretty damn good salesman. Back then, I'd go to this little place called TR's Bar and Grill in Concord and meet with the decorators, the designers, the builders, and manufacturers. And a couple hours later, five drinks and a handshake, I'm making a $30,000 deal. I'm really good at five cocktails and a handshake deal. And it just escalated. I started getting more and more involved in that. And I made really good money. And I was partying with all the people that were building Blackhawk. And one night they had the Tour d'Elegance, the grand opening of the south end of Blackhawk, the Street of Dreams. And there was 13 homes. And we had sold product to 10 of those homes. And it was my stepdad's shining moment. His shining moment. And I got there, and I didn't have my stuff with me that night for the first time. I thought they were going to, this is a party, right? They were supposed to party the way I did, because all the people that were there, I had partied with them most of the time. Nobody had anything. So I had to fake like I was sick, and I got up, and I left that party, most elegant, beautiful place that I'd been to in a while, and I drove under the freeway over to another place called Norris Canyon. And in Norris Canyon, there was a ranch that I was familiar with, and they had a laboratory, and they had any kind of substance you could possibly imagine. Along with that, there was a lot of bad characters there, and a lot of these characters would kick me around, roll me in the dirt just for fun if I made the wrong move. So I went there, willing to go to any length to get what I needed when I needed it. And from the most elegant to the most, horrible place you could imagine. But that's where this disease took me. Willing to do anything and see any characters and go to any length to fix my needs. So That continued. And finally, my stepdad gave me an ultimatum. He said, he didn't want to tell, he knew what was going on. And I, by this time, I was meeting people at midnight. If you showed up at midnight, back door of our warehouse, I had your product for you if you had my product for me. I wasn't selling it. I was stealing it and giving it away. And my stepdad didn't have the nerve to tell my mother that what a thief her son was until finally he did. And they gave me the ultimatum. They said, you got to go to, and he had gone to AA starting in 1962. My brother started AA in 1982, and this is in 1990. And so this ultimatum was go to AA for a week or you don't get your paycheck. See, now that's a dilemma for me because in my mind, I'm a man of honor. As soon as I get my paycheck, I pay the dope dealer and I pay the bar tab. And I really sincerely believe that, my life was manageable as a result of that. Now, at that point, I was in a bankruptcy. Our car had been repossessed. The government six figures. Had to move back in with mommy and daddy. And I thought I had it going on. So, I went to that room 410 in Pleasant Hill. There's a few people here that were at that particular meeting spot. And I went for a week, and I shook, and I sweat. I was a god-awful mess of detox. And, but I thought all the women were after me, because I had it going on. I thought all the guys thought I was their best friend, it just BS. So I made it a week, and didn't really hear too much, I was just so foggy and disconnected. But I felt something there, and I can't even describe it to this day. But then I went to the bar. They gave me my check. I went back to my bar, handed him my check. He cashed it. Guy sitting next to me tapping me on the leg with the bag like I did every week when I got my paycheck. And I looked over at Don's Corner. There's a guy in here now that knows about Don's Corner. And there was five double gins lined up. And I looked over and I'm going, that looks pretty good. And I heard the chatter. You said he was going to be dead at 40. You owe me $50. You said he wouldn't make it a week. And that was just enough to make me react differently than what I would have normally done, was take that bag and head for that Don's Corner. And I left right then and there. And I drove down the street. There's a little Safeway looking at Oak Park Liquors. I'm going, bar or meeting? Bar or meeting? I went to the meeting. Now, that's what I call my moment of grace from God. I'm a five cocktail and a bag of dope guy. I'm not a go-to-a-meeting, talk about spirituality and steps. And I have never looked back. That was in March of 1990. And I've been committed to this program since then. And I didn't get it right away. I knew I was an alcoholic, but I had the wrong definition. I thought that meant that I could drink more than anybody I met, and there was a few that might have kept up, but I was pretty much there, my new badge of honor, so I sat there in those meetings, and I listened. I got a sponsor. He didn't know he was my sponsor, because I never called him, and he called me out on that one day. I didn't see him there, and the guy sitting next to me, I said, Jay's my sponsor. He goes, Jay says, what? You've never talked to me once. And I don't know if many of you have had a fake sponsor, just so you can, people ask you if you got a sponsor, you can say, yeah, and you got a name, but that's what I did. And so then there's a guy that became my real sponsor. His name was Wes. And he said, we had something in common. We both loved to play golf, and so we were golfing. And he says, well, we're going to go in your backyard every week. And we're going to start reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and start working the steps. And I go, okay. And so I don't know what day of the week it was, but he finally said, read page 60 through 64, and I'm going to come over, and we're going to talk about that third step. And I go, And I'll tell you what, just You open my book, it opens up to page 62 because that describes what I really was. And it, in moving over it, it gave me my solution to get out of this thing. So he came over. He says, well, we're going to get on our knees. We're going to hold hands. And we're going to read the third step prayer together. Oh, no. Are you kidding me? So we get on our knees. I'm looking around the fence to make sure none of the neighbors are looking because I'm not hold another man's hand and pray guy. And we did that. It was the most, I've never had an experience like that in my entire life. I had this sudden and profound spiritual experience that shook my entire body. It was a vibration that I never had known prior to that. And I knew there was a power greater than myself. Previous to that, you know, I don't know if any of you have wrestled with the God question. I sure did. And my God was, well, you better believe in God in case there's a heaven and a hell. You want to be on the right side of that equation. And that all rattled around in my head for years. And then that day, I felt it in my heart. And what that did for me was it prepared me to move forward to do the rest of the work in the big book. Now I had a man and a God, just like the book says. And I was able to do a fourth step and a fifth step and discover what really made Don tick, not Don's self-delusion, his any of that stuff. I got to see how, and I was totally honest from the very beginning. Some more stuff has come up since then that I just had put away so deep, but I've taken care of it. But we were able to sit down and identify my shortcomings and my defects of character. And as we did that, I was able to start replacing those defects of character and those shortcomings with spiritual principles. And each step I took brought me closer to a God of my understanding because the truth had surfaced and I was good with it. And then it came to those amends, that amends, excuse me, portion. And I was ready. When I first got sober, the first week, I took on a second job and paid my stepdad the whole paycheck from that second job. Just intuitively knew that that's something I had to do. And at the end of the year, he said, we're good. And I don't know how much it was, but it was probably $400 or $500 a week at least, something like that. And in 1993, he got sick. Real sick. He had stage 4 cancer and lung cancer. And he said, Don, I want to give you the business. And I go, I really don't want this business. I'm just doing this to help you, you know. He had helped me so much. So I declined that. And as his illness got, so I helped him gracefully close the business. And then his illness took off really bad. And we were able to, I made him a promise. Made him a promise that you won't have to go through this cancer a minute alone. And him and my mom at this time lived in Rossmore, and I had remarried by then. This woman, she went first 3 years of our marriage. She went through hell, but she supported me ever since then. And so we went to Chinese food every Thursday for 9 months or something. One Thursday, he says, "Don, I can't make it. But will you sit with me tonight?" And I sat with him. We held hands. This is where I learned my service in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first service position I had, I'll back up one time. When I came in there, they made me the cigarette butt picker-upper. And I was going, why in the hell am I doing this, you know? I'm not sure about this. And so I went into the room one day, and they made an announcement. Don Johnson, the best cigarette butt picker-upper in the history of Pleasant Hill. They stroked my ego, because that ego was the only thing I had at that time. They stroked my ego, and they threw me into service. They let me be the water getter, not the coffee maker, the water getter. Then they made me greeter, and I've had a service commitment in AA ever since then, and I've learned to take it back to my family and back to my community. And so So with that stepfather, I sat with him that night. He pulled me in his arms, said, "Don, you've been a good son. I love you." You know, man, that was powerful. He died that night. I'd fallen asleep. Prior to him dying. Then in 2000, that mother of mine, I always tell these three stories because they're so powerful to me. This whole program is about love and healing. And so my mom had, she had a bypass surgery and it went horribly wrong. And she ended up getting MRSA, C. diff, congestive heart failure. She couldn't take care of herself anymore. And so we moved her into my home. And made a promise to her we'd take care of her until for the rest of her life if we needed to. And she was in and out of the hospital at Kaiser Walnut Creek. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with that campus. Right outside the main door, there's this beautiful oak tree with a circular bench around it. And I sat out there. She was in the hospital. She went back and forth to the hospital like 46 times. And that was my prayer tree. And it was so powerful. The nurses and the doctors came out and prayed with me, which was just an amazing, amazing thing. This program's so powerful. And reaching out to the community, that helped. So while she was there, she was in the back bedroom. And here's another good kicker. One of my more powerful lessons. That father of mine, that no good rotten bastard, who deserted me at 4 years old. You know, I had not really, my amends to him had been just not seeing him. And I'd semi-forgiven him, but he asked me, he says, "Don, I'm sick and I need help. Can you help me?" And I go, "Oh man, are you kidding me after all these years?" And that sponsor, thank God for good sponsorship. He told me, he looked me in the eye, he says, "Don, have you ever asked for forgiveness for the crap you did?" I go, "Well, yeah." And he told me, he says, "If you don't forgive that man and you carry that hatred in your heart, it's going to spill over into every other relationship that you have. And if you replace that with love, that love is going to spill over into every other relationship you have. Dad, you're moving into the driveway." So I had my dad in his motorhome in my driveway. I had my mom in the back room, the east wing and the west wing, and they did not magically get back together. This is in the year 2000, but we were able to sit at the table and break bread, heal those old wounds, and we started to replace the hatred and the resentment with love. You know, it was beautiful. And so he moved back up to Medford, Oregon. He got a job with the VA, moved up there. Not a job, he got a room with the VA. He moved back up there, and in the meantime, my mom took a turn for the worse. She had she ended up having a thoracic aneurysm, and she had to have her leg amputated, so I was there with her the whole time. And when they gave her 4 days to live, and I was with her, and she, you know, same thing. "Don, you've been a good son." You know, I was able to take care of her and be with her. It was the most difficult thing I've ever had to do in my life, but at the same time, it was the most beautiful spiritual experience to be there in the most intimate moments of life and death with another human being, especially your mother. I don't know how you can replace that with anything. Thank God, AA, for teaching me to show up for my family, teaching me to show up for my community. And she didn't want to be with anybody when she passed, and that was a tough one to honor. She said, "No, I want to be here by myself." I left. Oh, my God. She died an hour later, but that was her wishes, not mine. So we learned to match calamity with serenity. That's one of my favorite deals in this whole deal. So that father of mine, that ornery rascal, I went up to see him about every 10 days to 2 weeks. And there's a group up there called the Odd Fellows. He was in Medford, Oregon, and there's this group called the Odd Fellows in Jacksonville, right next to it. And I'll go one other story. His nurse took care of him, and they provided me a home It's called the Providence House. They gave it to me for free. Everybody that came up had a family member in the Providence Hospital. They put them up for free. And she turned me on to this group called the Odd Fellows, and they came over, and they visited. When I was gone, they came over to see my dad. They brought him food. They came over and picked me up, took me to meetings. AA is powerful, it's big, and they care. And, it was just a spectacular thing. And so finally, he took a real bad turn. He developed some heart problems and a brain tumor thing. And he went unconscious, and the hospital called, said before he did, he asked for you. So I came up, I drove up to Medford, Oregon, and went to the hospital. A friend of mine in the program drove up, brought my family to be with us, and we went to dinner. And they called me at dinner and said, Don, your dad came too. He's asking for you again. Whoa. We went back to the hospital. This is a man that never once told me that he loved me. I'd say, Dad, I love you. me too. He was a big, tough, strapping guy. Just soon fight you as talk to you, you know. And he grabbed me by the chest, by the shirt, pulled me into his arms, said, Don, I love you. First time ever. The love spilled over. And my buddy Rich says, you don't get that at the crack house, right? And you know, those are the love experiences I've had. This thing has been so healing and beautiful. I've made those amends with so many people. And it's just really, what a God blessing. And I hope you all get an opportunity. There's been a couple that were too late. They were gone. And I still find a few too late. But if you have a chance, clean it up. That there's my little preaching. So, while my mom was in the while we're taking care of her, I had told my boss that I was going to quit my job to take care of my mom. He said, if you do, you lose your pension, you lose your job. And at that point, I was not in fear of economic insecurity because it was the right thing to do. And I showed up for her. And in the meantime, I figured, what am I going to do? And I had some friends that ran Sober Living in Contra Costa County. And I said, you know what? I think I'll go back to college. And so I went back to college and to do addiction studies. And I had to do an internship. And the internship, I got invited to work at the Oakland Salvation Army. And prior to that, I said, you know, I'm going to be God-directed. Salvation Army is a church that does a 12-step program. God-directed? I think so. And so they actually hired me on. $10 an hour. Big time, you know? I mean, I was used to making a whole lot more money than that, but I found my passion. The book tells us our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. I found my passion working with the recovering alcoholics, and there was plenty of them there. There's some rough, tough people coming through there, but it gave me a direction that I wanted to go with in my life. And in a sense, I've opened sober living homes for men in recovery, and I've been doing that since 2002. And it keeps me on the front lines of this disease. I've been invited by a couple of different doctors at a couple of different hospitals to do a class. I'm not hired, and it's a group class on addiction. And I brought H&I in to make sure they get literature, but the class I do is just freestyle. It's about addiction, drugs, alcohol, whatever your deal is. And to see the light come on in these people's eyes is, you can't. There's no way to replace it for me. And I bring in somebody different. I was doing Thursday mornings, 10:30, and then they've just brought me in on Tuesday nights at 6 p.m. Don't be surprised if you get a phone call. I'm a blessed man. You know, I have a sponsor that I talk to at least three or four times a week. I have several sponsees, all at different levels of sobriety, and what a blessing that is, too. It keeps you fresh in the book. My second sponsor, I always like to tell this story. It's not the prettiest one, but it's a powerful one for me. It's a lesson learned. I took him on at 16 years sober. He became my first sponsor, the real one. I was sponsoring him by this time. We both decided it'd be fresh to get another sponsor. So I asked this other gentleman. Turns out my sponsor, that's the same guy. So this guy taught me more about prayer, meditation, spirituality, love than any man I'd met to this day. And he was a beautiful man. He moved to Sedona, and he was 22 years sober. And I was 17 years sober at the time. And I went down to visit him a few times, and then he started acting a little bit funny at one point, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. It was my 17-year sobriety birthday. I said, let's go to a meeting. He didn't know where a meeting was. That made me a little suspicious. So, I just kind of rolled with it, and then I got a call from his wife. He had joined the Jeep Club, the hiking club. She joined the wine club. The wine club was having one of their anniversary celebrations, and family was invited. And, of course, he was going to support his wife, right? He's a good husband. One glass of wine. Dead of wet brain dementia a year and a half later. Cunning, baffling, powerful, doing push-ups, sit-ups, running laps, staying in shape. Gotcha. I don't want to be that gotcha guy, so I stay close to this program. I love meetings. I love the fellowship. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, Mac. And we have a friend that says that every time he speaks. And, I get my daily bread here. I come here, and you guys feed me. My sponsor tells me I wake up every day with 7 hours of untreated alcoholism. Now, I don't know if that makes sense to you, but it makes sense to me. There's days I read my daily reflections. Oh, man, butterflies and rainbows. There's other days I read it, and it's like, what the hell did I just read? Those are the days I know that I got to pay attention. I got to dig in deeper. I got to talk to people. I got to figure out, because my brain is not my friend a lot of times. And so I ask for help. Oh, what a concept. I was supposed to be self-sufficient, take care of myself, But I've learned that asking for help is probably one of the greatest things we can learn around here. And so what I know is that I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And what are the things I got to do? I got to work with a sponsor. I got to work with sponsees. I got to come to meetings like this. I got to share my experience at hospitals and treatment centers if I have the opportunity. And stay connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard the expression, I'm sure you guys have too, don't let the life that AA gave you get in the way of your AA life. Too many people I know, I got this now. I think I can handle it on my own. Those are the scariest words I hear. I got this. So I'm going to keep showing up for places like this and with people like you and asking for your help and asking if I can help you. And I'm going to pray. I'm going to meditate. I love meditation. I love meditation. And one day at a time, I'm going to try to stay ahead of this demon alcohol, and I think I can do it if I do the things that I've been taught to do here. So I think that's probably good enough for me tonight. Thank you.